Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silk in Edinburgh, joined always by Frank Cogliano, who is finishing off his stint in Charlottesville. How are things there in Virginia, Frank?
They are great, David. As you probably know, having spent a lot of time in North Carolina, spring is one of the nicest seasons in this part of the country, and it's beautiful, beautiful right now. Not too hot yet.
Not too hot yet, but
Yeah.
wait until next week, right? Okay. The big news, one of the big news stories, of course, is the Donald Trump trial in New York City. And last week, Americans got to watch as prospective jurors were interrogated by the lawyers for both sides and by the judge about their ability to be impartial in this very controversial and potentially consequential case. So we thought we'd talk about the history of juries in American history this week. Frank, have you ever
We
been
should
on a
all.
jury?
I have not. I was called for jury duty in Scotland, but my number did not come up.
Okay.
And so I have never, and I haven't lived in the United States until this year, on a permanent basis in more than 30 years. So I've never been on a jury. Have you been on a jury?
I was on a jury actually here in Scotland about a year and a half ago. And it was fascinating in as much as the legal procedures in Scotland are different than England, and they're different than in the United States in some weird ways. And it was clear that everyone on the jury, and this seems to be common for Scottish juries, they understand the jury system primarily through movies and TV. And what they see on movies and TVs is mostly the American system and the English system. And so the judge had to constantly explain, I know you saw this on Law and Order, but actually, here's how things work here.
Oh,
It was
interesting. It's
fascinating. So there was a, what we thought and I guess imagine the same thing is true for American juries. They have a preconceived notion about what courtrooms are like based on television, and sometimes they're accurate, and sometimes they're not. But in this case, there were some very specific ways in which the Scottish legal standards were different that we had to have explained to us and sort of take on board. Rules of evidence and that kind of stuff.
right, and of course, there's a third verdict in Scotland, as opposed to
Yes.
guilty or not guilty, not
Yeah,
proven, right?
not proven.
Which I think is a really good option, frankly.
It's an interesting option, and I think I know there've been debates about getting rid of that third option, but it is an interesting sort of quirk to the Scottish legal system. So we're going to talk about juries.
One thing I will say is when I was called and then not chosen, it was during COVID. And so had I been chosen at that point, I would have gone to the local movie theater, the local cinema, to sit on the jury, because that's how they were doing things during the COVID pandemic in Scotland, which begged all kinds of questions. So you would have viewed the proceedings in the court via closed circuit TV, presumably. But I wonder, does that mean we get to get popcorn and snacks if we want to, while we're watching? But I never
Now,
discovered
we had very
any of that.
Scottish snacks at the High Court in Edinburgh. They had Iron Brew for us and Tunnock's tea cakes and all kinds of
Okay, good.
appropriately
Well,
Scottish things for us to eat during breaks.
this is all of what you're giving up, David, when you go to Florida.
I'll get Florida snacks if I get on the Florida jury. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, one of the things, though, thinking about juries comparatively that I've come across in sort of preparing for this episode is people who have written about juries internationally pointed out that most Western democracies use a jury system of some kind, but that American courts tend to use more juries more frequently. Obviously, there are some kind of legal procedures where you don't have juries, whether it's like bankruptcy court or family court or things, but American courts tend to be more jury centric than other Western democracies, and that juries have more power in the American system than they do in many other systems, which I think is an interesting way to sort of distinguish. And obviously, there are 51 at least different ways in which American juries work, because each of the states have different systems in the federal system and what have you. But I think this is a really sort of important part of American democracy people don't talk about enough, or people often try to get out of. So let's talk about history of juries, Frank.
Yeah, I would tell you, well, just before we get to that, in response to that statement, David, the Swede that I live with, is both fascinated and repelled by the American jury system, and frequently lectures me on it because in Sweden they use a panel of judges, which is very Swedish, kind of deferring to expertise. But
Peace, yeah.
but so
There's something very
different countries.
democratic about the American system, right? It's about sort of a jury of your peers, and
Well, that's what we
expertise
tell
matters less.
ourselves.
Yeah,
That's what we tell
that's the
ourselves.
idea.
I mean, the problem is, and again, if you watch crime procedurals, the system is often gamed, or at least Hollywood have us believe that. So whether but yes, it's got democratic origins, which is I think one of the things we need to talk about. Anyway, let's move on. Sorry, one other thing before we start, David, is it's not just the Trump trial that has us thinking about juries, but O.J. Simpson died a week or so back, which led to a lot of news coverage about the not just Simpson's life and the notorious jury trial he was involved in 1995, but also reflections on how that verdict divided Americans back in 1995, almost 30 years ago. So,
Yeah, whether the jury got it right or not, exactly.
So juries have been on our mind in the past week. So the first jury trial in what became the United States in the then American colonies was held in 1630 in Massachusetts, actually Plymouth Colony, before it was joined with Massachusetts. And a man named John Billington was accused and convicted of murdering another colonist named John Newcomen. And this is the first recorded jury trial in what would become the United States. It should be said the colonists who settled what will become British America, and at that point it was English America in the 17th century, brought with them the English legal tradition. I'm saying English deliberately here. Juries are mentioned in a kind of indirect way in Magna Carta as a kind of right. Now, Magna Carta's status as a charter of rights is complicated, but the
That's a different
jury
podcast.
system, yeah, that is a different podcast, and it's not one we're really qualified to be on, I think. But the jury system is, was inherited and imported directly from English common law by English, latterly British colonists in North America, from a relatively early period in 1641. Oh, sorry, in 1635, Massachusetts, the colony of Massachusetts, introduces the grand jury system. And grand juries are kind of something that listeners will be familiar with. Grand juries basically decide whether there's a case to an a answer. And what we think of as a normal jury is a petty jury, a small jury, as opposed to a grand jury, which actually hears the cases. In 1641, Massachusetts decreed that all free men should serve on juries. And I think one thing we might get into today, I don't know, we'll see how much time we have, is there's the question of the jury itself, but then who's qualified to be a juror, who should serve on a jury, which of course will change dramatically. And that debate very closely follows debates and considerations about who's qualified to vote in both colonial America and after independence in the United States of America. And unsurprisingly, the debates over who's fit to serve on a jury and who's eligible to vote are really following close in tandem, I think. So those are the early origins, and we can talk, and I can speak in a minute or two about the role of juries in the era of the American Revolution, because I think that's quite important, and it goes to that statement you made about it being a democratic institution, because I think that conception is enshrined by the Revolution. But talk about some of the more famous colonial cases, David, because you have
Yeah,
a couple in mind.
well, there's you mentioned common law, and the first one I think is worth mentioning is the trial of William Penn in 1670. William Penn is famously the guy who founded Pennsylvania. And he was put on trial in 1670 for basically being a Quaker. There were laws passed in England against preaching outside of the Church of England, and William Penn's other guy, William Meade, did so, and they were arrested for it, And thinking about what jury trials looked like in the 17th century, there were juries, but they largely rubber stamped what the prosecution, what the crown wanted them to do. And in this case, the jury said, "Yeah, we think he, he clearly did the things that he's being accused of, but we are not going to convict him of it." And what the judge did, and this seems to have been moderately common when juries didn't behave, at least the way the judge thought him did, he locked the jury up, and he said, "I'm going to lock you up until you provide the verdict that I think is the right verdict. I am going to deny you food or drink or heat or tobacco." Those are the four things he denied them. And he then fined them. And one of the jurors refused to pay the fine. And it sort of leads to a series of other legal decisions. It's called the sort of Bushell case. Basically says that like jurors can't be punished for not doing what the judge wants them to do. It sort of gives juries some independence from the judge and makes them deciders of fact, if you will. And I think that's a really sort of important sort of pivot point in terms of the role of the jury both in English common law, but also thinking about William Penn's subsequent life in the United States. What becomes the United States, he imports this idea into Pennsylvania and other places that the jury really is supposed to be, gets to decide. And if the judge doesn't like the decision of the jury, that's the judge's problem. He can't sort of punish the jury for being not reaching the same conclusion that he does. There's another really important case, the John Peter Zenger case in New York in 1735. Zenger was the publisher of the New York Weekly Journal, which was a newspaper, and he wrote some articles that were very critical of the royal governor of New York. He was thrown in jail for libel, spends a number of months in jail, and the jury finds him not guilty, despite the fact the judge basically told them, like, look, he's guilty, you have to find him guilty. The jury again made the sort of independent decision that he wasn't guilty. Because they said, look, actually, the things he said, even if they were critical of the royal governor, they were actually true, and therefore you can't be convicted of libel for saying true things. So it's a case of a really sort of activist jury reframing what the law means. And I think that's often sort of cited as a really important case in terms of first or freedom of the press kinds of issues or prefacing the First Amendment. But it's also a really important case in terms of the independence of a jury and the ability of a jury to sort of step outside of the legal framework that they're given and say, actually, we're going to do something else entirely. How about in the revolution? I think the courts factor in pretty heavily and juries factor in pretty heavily into the revolution and the things colonists are angry about in the 1770s.
They do. I mean, in the Declaration of Independence, one of the kind of charges, one of the indictments against George III is the king was criticized for, quote, depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury. And in the decade previous, so between 1765 with the Stamp Act crisis down to 1775, 76, there were a number of obviously incidents of violent demonstration and against British rule, and these often resulted in criminal charges against individuals. And there were a number of instances where the right to trial by jury became an issue in the run-up to the revolution. So, for example, after the British occasionally, the British state occasionally tries to, after the Boston Tea Party, it as part of the so-called coercive acts to punish Massachusetts for resisting British rule, they propose a law to remove. Well, they don't. Pro they adopt a law to remove people from the colony for trial. And this is seen as an abridgment of the right to trial by jury, because the crucial a crucial aspect of trial by jury is not just that you're going to be tried by a jury of your, or before a jury of your peers, but they will be you'll be tried in your community by the people who know you. And so removing people, and there was also talk, there were occasions where protesters were brought before admiralty courts, which is to say military courts, naval courts run by the British rather than civilian courts. And so these instances are behind that grievance. Famously, after the Boston Massacre in 1770, the soldiers who were tried for murder in Boston for shooting civilians in that city were tried in Massachusetts. And John Adams was one of the people who defended those soldiers in court and took the position that the rule of law is really important, and we have to show Britain that indeed British soldiers and British officials can get fair trials in the colonies. And most of those soldiers were acquitted or convicted of lesser charges as a result of that trial. Adams said famously that representative government and trial by jury are the heart and lungs of liberty. Without them, we have no other fortification against being ridden like horses, fleeced like sheep, worked like cattle, and fed and clothed like swine and hounds. So it's interesting there that he is associating, and he said that in 1774, I believe, he's making a clear connection between representative government and trial by jury. So what we see in the revolutionary era, there's a clear connection between jury trials, which is seen as one of the inherent rights of Englishmen, as they've phrased it, and representative government. Jefferson said, there's always a Jefferson quote, "I consider trial by jury as the only anchor ever yet imagined by man by which government can be held to the principles of its constitution." So again, we're seeing a direct correlation in the thinking of the revolutionaries between trial by jury, a right they've inherited and imported from Britain over nearly two centuries before, and republican government, and ultimately in your century, democratic government with a small d. And it's enshrined, therefore, and we get it in the Bill of Rights in 1791, in two amendments, in the Sixth Amendment, which guarantees the right to trial by jury in criminal cases, and the Seventh Amendment, which guarantees the right to trial by jury in civil cases. And so it's enshrined
And in the
as a
Fifth
kind of
Amendment, because you've
right,
got the
yes.
grand jury, and you've
Of
got
course.
Article 3 also mentions juries.
Yeah.
So there's a
So,
bunch of places where the Constitution's,
and it's, yeah, and it's, it's enshrined as a kind of key legacy of the revolution. And as those quotes from Adams and Jefferson suggest, because it's closely aligned in the thinking of the revolutionaries with representative government.
Yeah, it's intriguing because like those parts of the Constitution are actually the least controversial bits of the Constitution for the most part. People seem to be generally agreeable that those things are important.
Yeah, we debate the right, there have been endless debates in American history about who has the right to vote and who should have the right to vote, and how do you extend the franchise and citizenship? Nobody's contested whether there should be trial by jury, as far as I can tell. There's no serious movement against there have been attempts to game the system, as we'll see, and so on, but everybody seems to, it's one thing I think Americans across the political spectrum and regardless of their philosophy seem to agree on. Would you
I would, I mean,
accept
there's
that?
obviously debates about who should be on that jury and whether the
Sure.
jury, but and there's we'll get to that. I mean, one of the things thinking about the revolution that I came across, there are 12 states that rewrite their constitutions prior to the US Constitution. And the one right that all of those have in common is the right to a trial by jury. Some of them have freedom of religion, some of them have other things, freedom of speech, but the one right is that they all seem to have in common is this right of trial by jury. So it seems to be, one of those things based rock, bedrock principles of the revolution that seems to be very important. Now, but getting back to the Boston Massacre trial, I mean, one of the concerns that presumably the British soldiers have is they're not going to, they thought they couldn't get a fair trial in Boston because they're being tried by Bostonians who don't like them.
Right.
And one of the concerns that Trump has articulated in this trial is he says, look, Manhattan is made up of mostly Democrats who don't like me. I can't get a fair trial here. And I think if we're going to sort of take the British perspective in the revolution and the removal of things to admiralty courts and what have you, I think maybe their argument, I guess, would have been colonists can't be trusted to be fair jurors.
Right. That's right.
When we get to the 19th century, I think we end up with sort of two competing ideas about juries. And one of these is really clearly articulated by Alexis de Tocqueville, who talks about everything. But in the 1830s, he talks about American democratic institutions, and he talks about juries as being one of the very important ones, right? That juries are one of the places where Americans get to see equity in practice. So, if politics is about trying to embody your principles into law, here's about how you actually do it in practice. And de Tocqueville was generally very positive about the American jury system. And he's talking about it in the context, and you mentioned sort of the right to the linkage between the right to vote and the right to serve on juries. This is at a point in which most of the property qualifications for serving on juries and those other kinds of qualifications had for white men had been taken away. The intriguing thing, thinking about the sort of the relationship between those two things, is the right to serve on jury actually usually lags the right to vote. And I think we see that for propertyless men, you see that for African Americans, you see that for women, that actually the right to vote tends to precede the right to serve on a jury, at least in practice. So the other perspective on juries in the 19th century is our other person, I guess we quote a lot in this show, and that's Mark Twain, who says a number of very critical things about juries, or at least humorously critical. One I found from 1873: "We have a criminal jury system which is superior to any in the world, and its efficiency is only marred by the difficulty in finding 12 men every day who don't know anything and can't read." And I guess the premise there, and I think you saw this a bit in the discussions last week, people who end up on juries, sometimes the sort of stereotype is they're people who don't have other things going on in their lives. And that was a stereotype that existed in the 19th century, that the people who ended up not finding an excuse to be in on a jury were people who were unemployed, on the fringes of society, not well educated about the matters of the day. And I think that concern, I think, was raised last week. How can you find 12 people, I guess 18 if you include the alternates, who don't have a strong opinion about Donald Trump and haven't read about the case, right? And I think we've seen that in other sort of celebrity cases where it's hard to find people who are truly neutral, but also have good judgment, if that's one of the things you're looking for in a jury.
Yeah, but sorry, two responses to what you just said, David. First, in terms of the lag behind voting rights and jury service, just to illustrate that point, women weren't allowed to serve on juries in Massachusetts until 1950, so 30 years after the 19th Amendment. So that's to illustrate that point. With regard to the qualifications for jurors, there was a lot of coverage and talk about this last week with regard to the ongoing trial of former President Trump in Manhattan. One thing that I thought was really helpful that came out of that coverage and analysis was that it was made clear in the better analysis that they weren't looking for jurors who'd never heard of President Trump or his travails or had no opinion. In fact, they questioned them closely about what they read, what they know, and so on. It was whether those people could demonstrate to the satisfaction of the lawyers on both sides that they could be fair in judging President Trump. So it wasn't, now in some cases they looked at people's social media posts and ruled them out as a result of, they were fervently critical of President Trump or fervently in favor of President Trump. But it wasn't that, and I think there was a level of nuance in the jury selection that was helpful as far as educating the public, because
To
it's
be
not
sure.
that, I mean, Twain's funny and Twain's quote is funny, but it's not actually that somebody has to need know nothing about the matter at hand. And I think they know that the 18 people they selected will have opinions about President Trump. It's whether they are able to set them aside in order to assess the evidence. And we, I guess, have to have faith that the system works.
I mean, I think part of what Twain is riffing off there is a sentiment in the 19th century: the juries were kind of corrupt, right? That jurors would show up drunk, that jurors were susceptible to bribes, that jurors were not necessarily the best and brightest of society. And that seems to have been, you know, politics was pretty corrupt in the 1870s in a variety of ways, and I think juries, that extends to juries as well.
So, David, do you have kind of notorious trials of the 19th century? Do you have the Ripley's Believe It or Not list of 19th
Well,
century trials?
there's a whole bunch of, there's sort of categories of trials, I think, where juries are factoring pretty heavily. And probably the one that interests me the most are trials that are arising from the Fugitive Slave Act, which was passed in 1850. It's obviously one of these very important milestones in terms of sectional crisis leading to the Civil War. It basically empowered enslavers to use courts to return to apprehend enslaved people who had fled to northern states. We have a number of examples of jury trials in those, in cases both involving the Fugitive Slave Act and things sort of adjacent to it, in which northern juries simply refuse to indict people who are, at least based on the letter of the law, guilty. There's a series of cases in Syracuse, New York, in which people are 24 people are indicted for helping a fugitive man who was a fugitive from slavery, and they basically, you know, within a few minutes say, no, we're finding all these people not guilty. There was a famous riot in Pennsylvania, the Christiana riot in 1851, in which Edward Gorsuch, who was an enslaver from Maryland and the ancestor of a current member of the Supreme Court, went to go and try to recover some what he thought were fugitive slaves from Pennsylvania. A number of people in this town physically fought back against them, and the jury found all of them not guilty in a matter of minutes. So we have a number of cases like that, in which juries are actively rejecting the law they're intended to enforce. And we find a similar kind of thing going on during Prohibition in the 1920s, where juries are very unwilling to actually enforce the dictates of the law, right? And I think that those are areas in which, you know, juries are really manifesting themselves very powerfully. And one of the big questions, though, in the 19th century, the end, second half of the 19th century, and into the 20th century, is who gets to be on a jury, right? That how do jurors get selected? What is the sort of process for selecting the usually 12 people to be on a jury? And there's some really sort of huge debates both in Congress and at the state level about what are the how those jurors get selected and what are the consequences when you end up with, say, an all-white jury, which tended to be the case in most of the South for most of the 19th and the first half of the 20th century, you know, in which African Americans in a variety of ways were either prevented from being in the jury pool or if they're in the jury pool, were systematically excluded from actually serving on juries. And this was, I think, a really sort of a big civil rights fight going alongside, as you point out, sort of voting rights. You know, what kind of justice can you get if you don't have any people of color on your jury? And, you know, so if we're trying to explain, you know, why is it that lynching happens so frequently in the South and without any legal ramification, you know, it's because white Southerners understood that the juries that they would be facing would be all white juries that would acquit them. And there's a number of Supreme Court cases where they try to sort of push back against this, but they're largely ineffective until the 20th century. There's a series of cases in which the court tries to, you know, challenge state prohibitions against African Americans serving on juries, but clever racists find ways around those and sort of legal workarounds to prevent that. You know, actually, it's not really until 1986, and this is always very striking to me, that the Supreme Court rules that you can't exclude someone. One of the processes that we saw this week was through the examination of individual jurors by the counsel for both sides. And one of the things that counsel can do is you can exclude jurors. They're called peremptory challenges, where you can say, no, this particular juror, we don't want him. It wasn't until 1986 that the Supreme Court said that race was not a criteria you could use to kick somebody off the jury. So each side gets a certain number of people they get to sort of exclude based on these kind of peremptory challenges. And what often had happened was that African-Americans would have been excluded using that process if they had been even allowed to get that far in the process, in the jury pool process. But now what's called a Bateson challenge gives them protection there. And there are other categories that have been subsequently added to that sort of legal framework. But we have lots of examples of all white juries making some really horrible conclusions, both to let white perpetrators of violence get off the hook, but also to punish African Americans, whether that's in the context of convict leasing, the Scottsboro Boys case from the 1920s, and what have you. So it's a pretty ugly scene about what a jury of your peers looks like if your peers are all a different race than you are as a defendant.
Yeah, I guess it comes down to how you describe a peer, you know. Yes. who's a peer?
I'm thinking about times in which monarchs in Europe were executed, and they always said, well, you can't put me on trial because I have no peers. I guess one of the premises in a democracy is that all citizens are peers, and at least on some level.
One of the interesting things about the opening of the Trump trial yesterday, so we're speaking on Tuesday. This sounds like the NPR podcast. We're speaking on Tuesday, the 23rd of April. But in the opening statements yesterday, President Trump's lawyer, wrapped up by saying, "We're all New Yorkers," which he was deliberately trying to make Trump a peer of the jurors and also appealing to them as counsel, as a fellow New Yorker. So there was a deliberate attempt that in wrapping up, and he basically said, we're all New Yorkers here. Come on, let's be smart about this. There's no crime here.
Listeners, send your complaints about Frank's New York accent.
That was my Boston accent. That was a Bostonian impersonating a New Yorker.
New Yorker,
But that was I thought that was an interesting flex, and it was an interesting kind of attempt to appeal to a New York jury as a New Yorker, which I thought apropos of this, but
I mean, one of the issues though that came up, I think, a lot last week, is about the privacy of the jury. Right, the anonymity of the jury. There's a lot of reporting about who the potential jurors were, about how old they were, where their race and gender in some cases. One potential juror, I think, was selected, but then asked to be taken off the jury because her family figured out she was on the jury because of media reports, because they talked about where she had worked. How do we sort of unpick historically the right of a jury to be anonymous versus the right of the public to know who is making important decisions?
Well, of course, historically, juries weren't necessarily anonymous. In a lot of cases, they're not. But in particular, cases where the jury and where jury tampering is a danger, that's often where anonymity becomes an issue, and or where jurors might be threatened by their participation in the jury. And there's some evidence given. I mean, we've never seen a trial like this. We've never seen a jury trial like this in U.S. history, I think, where the accused is quite as prominent as this. There have been other celebrity trials, and we'll probably talk about one or two of them within the next few minutes, but nothing like this, particularly where the individual concerned. Well, we've never had a former president of the United States face criminal charges before, for a start. So this really
Exactly.
is unprecedented, let alone the fact that he has a reasonable chance of becoming the president of the United States again. And so this is a really unique set of circumstances. However, in lots of organized crime trials, for example, there's a need to keep the jurors to protect the anonymity of the jurors, to protect their safety and so on. So there is some precedent for protecting the anonymity of jurors in a high profile case. There is a lot of information out there. I mean, the New York Times had a story this morning about the backgrounds of the jurors, that and they had a sort of grid showing what media they got their news from, because jurors had to answer questionnaires about that. And so there's a lot
And the
of
questionnaires are
information.
then public, right? And so it's very strange because, on the one hand, we want justice that, to be transparent. We want, the process to be as open as one can. But then there's these questions about, they're answering some very private questions, I think. Some of the questions they were asked on the jury questionnaire, that if they perjure themselves on that, they can go to jail for that. So they have to be very honest. But then having that on the New York Times, I'm not sure that's that seems like a invasion generally of kind of privacy one might want to have.
Yeah, so there's a tension here between transparency, and this is meant to be a feature. And in your earlier comments, you were kind of seemed to be buying into this as a kind of feature of the democratic system, and it's a good thing, in which case it needs to be open. On the other hand, just as voting is private, so too maybe jury participation should be.
Well, you mentioned the OJ trial earlier, which was a fascinating trial in part because it was entirely televised. And so I think, there was a decent chunk of the country that watched that entire trial. We knew a great deal about the judges and the judge and the lawyers and the witnesses and all the kind of stuff. But we never saw the jury, right? And there were all these kinds of ways in which the jury was intended to be protected from that kind of public scrutiny. But how do you sort of, and I think there was lots of reporting going on last week, in addition to giving us all these details about the jurors, about whether it's a good idea to give us all these details about the jurors.
What
Is
do you
it
think? I don't think we need to know this information about the jurors. I mean, personally.
yeah well it's we're in a weird place now because information is so easy to access, and it's very hard to keep information from people, right? And so, jury questionnaires, I think those maybe should be private. Does that then lead to problems where people think maybe they don't have a jury that is, representative or actually jury of his peers, if that's a concern.
I
I
mean,
mean, those people.
if Trump is convicted, there's no doubt that he will claim that he was a victim of an unfair jury, and that many of his supporters will believe that. I'm quite sure of that, in part because the cases in New York, that we're already seeing that. But on the other hand, the legal process is supposed to be separate from the political process, and should be in this case, because it's a criminal case. So I'm not so naive as to believe that this doesn't have political implications. Of course it does. And all the legal cases that Trump's facing are political and have political dimensions to them. But I think to the extent we can separate these things, we should. And therefore, I think the privacy of the jurors should be paramount, frankly.
I agree.
Now, interestingly, I mean, you mentioned the Simpson trial. That was televised, which was a big part of why it occupies the space in our kind of popular culture that it does, and political culture, frankly. And I, well, although I think the jury should be kept anonymous in the Trump trial to the extent that that's possible, I think the trial should be should be televised, actually. I think and it's not being televised in this case, so we're relying on it's quite old school. We're relying on kind of print reporters and live feeds from people on
Yeah.
social media saying and some pretty dubious artist sketches of what's going on. One thing I'll say about sorry, the television of the televising of the OJ trial, though, David, before I forget it, is we'd never heard the name Kardashian before the OJ trial. And we're still living with the consequences of
Just that,
then Robert Kardashian's
yes.
fame, which then led to the Kardashian empire.
Yes, among other things. I guess the peril of televising things beyond putting courtroom sketch artists out of work. I think there is a sense in which, and I think lots of judges have reached this conclusion, that when you televise trials, it makes it a media circus in a way that people are performing for the camera, and that has consequences for the way that the law actually unfolds. That people might be trying to get a book deal or some kind of celebrity out of it, rather than, especially in these kinds of trials, and that obviously was the case in the OJ trial. And courts in the United States and courts in other parts of the world are, I guess, you have similar considerations for this. How open do you want them to be? How democratic do you want them to be? How accessible do you want them to be versus how sort of ceremony, how solemn do you want them to be? And, the Supreme Court, for instance, doesn't televise its hearings. You can go and sit and watch them if you wait in line. If it's you don't have to wait in line very long if it's a boring case, but you have to wait in long, if it's a more controversial case. They used to release audio recordings afterwards in recent decades, and now they're releasing audio recordings live, which is fascinating. So you can listen to them, but you can't watch them, which is an interesting distinction, and it's unclear how long that's going to last. But in this case, we're getting transcripts later in the day, and we're getting sort of media accounts by people who are in the room. But yeah, I think it'd be interesting to televise it. We'd catch Trump falling asleep, which seems to be a thing that happened a lot last week.
I want to defend Trump sleeping.
Okay.
As somebody who spends a lot of time in meetings, he's an old guy, and a lot of this stuff is procedural and boring. I mean, it's not a good look, admittedly.
Fair
Um,
enough.
but but I have a feeling a lot more people fall asleep in court than simply Donald Trump.
Well, that's probably the case. Although, if any of the jurors fall asleep, then people might have some
I
concern
think
about
that's true.
the lawyers or the judges.
One of the
But it
problems is
wasn't.
because of TV, we are conditioned, and I think everybody who participates is conditioned. I mean, it was interesting, you began this episode by talking about the admonition from the Scottish judge about this. We are conditioned to think the court's going to go a certain way, and things move pretty quickly, and it's all dramatic and everything else. And that's simply not the case. Like warfare, legal proceedings are actually slow, and a lot of it's quite boring, and seemingly not much is happening for long periods of time. So I think that I'm not surprised that Donald Trump dozed off, and I suspect he may do so again.
Yeah. Well, th there were some intriguing moments last week where they, as they were doing the interviews with the prospective jurors, where they had to quote social media postings by some of the prospective jurors that were critical of Trump right to Trump's face, and which was intriguing in terms of him confronting a hostile audience. He seemed very happy when they had read Art of a Deal.
Yes. I mean, that was a little bit. Is it Jimmy Kimmel who does the mean tweets feature where he has celebrities
Yes.
meet read mean tweets about
Tweets about
themselves?
themselves. Yes,
And
I
it's
don't think
quite
Trump.
no. I mean, what's interesting there, though, David, is in terms of so not Trump falling asleep, but how his interaction with the jury is going to unfold, because he's not used to having his behavior controlled in the way that it is as a defendant in a criminal trial.
Hmm.
You know, the judge had to tell him to sit down at one point last week. And so, and if I were one of Trump's lawyers, I'd be really worried about his facial expressions and whether he, because the kind of, frankly, over the top expressiveness that he uses to good effect, frankly, politically, might not play well with the jury.
I've heard some legal commentators suggest that maybe he's been given a longer leash than most defendants would in similar circumstances. But, you know, there's a end point even for a very long leash.
Yeah, but it's not even that. I'm not talking about him being sort of sanctioned during the trial and he may be held in contempt. I think that's one of the things that's being considered right now in terms of his social media activity outside of the courtroom. But I'm talking about in terms of the kind of calculus that lawyers make and defense lawyers make in particular about how their client is influencing the jury or could influence in the jury in terms of, you know, that's why they always dress well. That's why they, you know, you try to convey a certain image to the jury, and Trump's behavior is so idiosyncratic and he's difficult to control. All of his lawyers admit this. So that this could, well, I have a feeling that this is a concern for his defense team in a way it wouldn't be for almost any other defendant, because they don't know how that will play. So it's not just how his behavior plays with the judge, but how it plays with the jury, which is our theme today. So briefly, David, one thing I thought of, because I realize we're running on a bit. It seems to me that the most notorious jury cases, at least in recent, and I'm using recent in a fairly capacious way, history, are incidents where the jury acquits when the public thinks that they've got a good idea of what happened. And the two most notorious ones that I can think of, and I think these are related in a certain way, are the Rodney King trial. So when the motorist Rodney King was beaten by the police in Los Angeles in the early 1990s, and that trial in 1992, and when the police were acquitted for assaulting Rodney King, and you know, seemingly everybody in America saw that video. There was outrage, and in fact, there were riots in Los Angeles in 1992 as a response to that. But the Rodney King acquittal was one, and then 3 years later, the acquittal of O.J. Simpson. And I think in part, the response to the acquittal of O.J. Simpson was engendered because of the response to the Rodney King decision and the subsequent riots and the kind of racial climate in Southern California in the early 90s after the Rodney King decision in part influenced the response of people, black and white, the very different responses of people in the United States, black and white, to the O.J. Simpson verdict. But those are the two I'm thinking of.
Well, thinking about the Rodney King case, one of the things that happened in that trial was that the defendants asked for a change of venue because they couldn't get a jury that would be fair to them within Los Angeles, right? And so one of the things that you know, the Sixth Amendment says is the jury's supposed to come from the place where the crime is committed, with reasonable exceptions for things. And they argued that you know, they couldn't get a fair trial in Los Angeles. And Donald Trump, I think, made the same argument, or Donald Trump's lawyers made the same argument, you know, last week. They said, look, we need to either move it out of Manhattan or expand the jury pool to include more people from Staten Island, which he thought would be more likely to be partial to Trump or something. You know, so the question about, you know, is the jury fair? Where can one get a fair jury? And if it's a fair jury to the defendant, is it a fair jury then to the, you know, for the public?
That's right. The Rodney King trial was in Simi Valley, California, which is 40 miles from downtown Los Angeles, although Los Angeles County is actually vast. But Simi Valley is
demographically different.
Demographically different, but also lots of law enforcement live there. Mm-hmm. And it's quite friendly to law enforcement. And so, yeah, I mean, the venue was key to that decision, I think. I'm glad you mentioned that. That's certainly true. So we're in unprecedented territory. The current Trump trial mean for the jury system in America? I know I'm asking you to make a prediction, and all of our predictions are wrong. But, you know, will we come away thinking, you know what? The jury system works. It's flawed, but it's a key, it's a cornerstone to the system, to our democratic system, and that's the way it should be. Or are we going to be outraged? Or what do you
Yeah.
think?
Well, so in federal trials, and this is true in at the state level and but not all states in all cases, you need to have a unanimous decision by the jury. And so all it takes is one juror throwing his hands up or her hands up or their hands up and saying, no, I'm not going to convict when everyone else is persuaded of something. And so the jury outcomes can be very unpredictable because it's not about what the majority of the 12 people think, it's what probably one of the 12 people think. One of my favorite movies, and I guess it's a play as well, is 12 Angry Men from the 1950s, which is sort of based on this premise that one juror can hold up the process and possibly lead to a different result and what have you. But it does mean that the outcome of a jury trial can be thrown very quickly by one badly chosen juror, if that's the way you want to think about it. And I think this is one of those cases where regardless of the result, there's going to be a lot of people who are angry about it. I think that I can predict with some certainty. What about you, Frank? What do
Right,
you
but
think?
my question is, do you think the jury system will be vindicated by this? Because while we find the need for unanimous verdict annoying sometimes, it's meant to protect the accused,
Yeah.
which
You
has to
don't
be a
need
good
it.
thing, right?
Well, you don't need a unanimous jury in Scotland.
Right, I know. It can be.
One can imagine a scenario in which Trump is convicted, in which Trump supporters, in a sort of parallel attack on other kinds of democratic institutions, see this as illegitimate. One can imagine that scenario quite easily. I guess it depends on how the case unfolds and
Yeah,
whether
I
there's
mean,
a disjuncture between
I'm asking.
what we think is happening in the courtroom and what the evidence looks like.
That's right. And I'm asking you to speculate about it. We're in the second day of this trial,
Sure.
and who knows how it's going to go. I mean, the one thing that's complicated about this trial is the law itself, and I am not a lawyer, as listeners to this podcast will know. But it's not just. Did he pay hush money to Stormy Daniels? And because if he did, that's a misdemeanor, right? It's that he did so in seeking to influence the outcome of the election. That's what makes it a felony. So it's actually there's
Well,
another
and
layer of this
it's
that.
about business reporting of
Right.
expenses as one thing when in fact it's something else in further, so there's, I mean, one of the big problems I think with jury trials generally is the law is complicated. People
Yeah, and
do it for a living.
this is a complicated case.
There are some, and it's intriguing though that the American system does entrust to juries the potential to sort of figure all these things out, and this is a moderately complicated case. There are obviously some financial cases that are extraordinarily complicated, but we entrust the juries to be able to figure those things out. And one of the things that's interesting about jury trials in the United States is we do often have juries for civil cases, which doesn't happen as much in other countries, where they have to make decisions about complicated legal and financial matters, which are usually above and beyond the sort of common understanding of citizens on the street. So lawyers have to educate them and judges have to educate them. And then they have to make decisions about punitive damages and all these other kinds of things that are pretty complicated. And I think it's a feature of the system that we trust 12 randomly selected citizens to make these kinds of choices.
Yeah, I mean, I guess with this case, with the various cases that Trump is facing, this on one hand is seems to be straightforward. It's the most salacious, right? But it's actually quite complicated legally. Whereas, for example, the classified documents case seems to me to be much more straightforward. Either he did it or he didn't, and then the kind of the narrative is clearer, it seems to me. But we'll see how it plays
We'll
out.
see how it plays out. Right.
Yeah.
Well, All right, time for last drops, Frank. What do you have a judgment on, an opinion, expert opinion
Okay,
on? You want to make a judgment?
I am going to express an opinion that could be controversial,
Okay.
but it is clear. It's not, this is not a history related last drop, but it is a literal last drop because it's about a beverage.
About a beverage, okay.
I, as you know, was recently on the road. Every spring I go on the road with Edinburgh University and colleagues to meet alumni and to go to the Tartan Day Parade and meet applicants to the university. And I enjoy this trip very much. I did an abbreviated version of it this year because I'm obviously working here at Monticello. So I went to New York, Boston, Toronto, and Atlanta recently. And I would like to say unequivocally, clearly and unequivocally, that the iced tea in Canada is better than the iced tea in the southern United States. And I would like to defend this position as follows. I'd like to explain this as follows. So I drink a lot of iced tea. I always drink unsweetened iced tea because I find the sweet tea down here in the South to be so sweet as to be undrinkable. It's just awful. Right? It'll dissolve your teeth before you even swallow it, and it'll give you diabetes, and it's just awful. It's
Okay, I think you've just
far,
disqualified
far.
yourself from jury's duty in most of the South as
Fair enough,
being
but it
the
is
person of good
far
judgment.
too sweet. It is
Okay.
far, far too sweet for me. And I was, and so I drink unsweetened iced tea, and it's fine. Unsweetened iced tea is great. Anyway, I was found myself in Canada a couple of weeks ago, and I asked the server for some unsweetened iced tea, and she said, "Oh, we don't have that here." And I thought, "Well, that's really?" And she said, "Yeah, we don't." She said, "We have semi-sweet tea here in Canada." And she said, "I'll bring you a taste." And she brought me a taste, and they have semi-sweet tea. It's probably the way iced tea used to be in the United States 40 years ago before we became addicted to sugar, or maybe 400 years ago. Anyway, and it is really, really good. It's got a little bit of sugar, so which of course is addictive. It's our most addictive drug, but it is so much better than sweet tea in the southern United States. And I will die on this hill. And she said, "That's great, isn't it?" And I was like, "Yeah, this is really, really good." She said, "That's why we don't have unsweetened iced tea in Canada." I don't know whether that's true. This is what the server was telling me. This was not a scientific survey, but I will say the semi-sweet tea, iced tea in Canada is far superior to the sweet tea here in the South. And I realize that's a controversial take. I will also say one thing that annoys me, and now that I'm on my iced tea rant, is it really annoys me down here that you have to ask for hot tea when you want tea. Tea should be the hot beverage and iced tea should be the cold beverage. But I
Yeah,
realize language is
I've had
fluid.
relatives from the South visit us here and ask for tea with meals, and were then surprised when the beverage was hot,
Yeah, but
because the default is, well, it's like hockey.
right.
If you say hockey in Britain, they think you're talking about field hockey. If you say hockey in the United States, it's ice hockey.
I went to the Hockey Hall of Fame too when I was in Toronto, but that's
Oh,
another
okay,
story.
that's a
That's
different story.
great. Not as good as the Bluegrass Hall of Fame, which I went to a month ago. But anyway, so I've been ticking off my halls of fame. The
Fame, that's good.
Hockey Hall of Fame was good. Nice exhibition on the centenary of the Boston Bruins. So I was pleased about that. In fact, let me talk about the Hockey Hall of Fame too, David, because as we're checking in, as we're buying our tickets, I'm with my colleague Scott, who's Scottish. And they ask us where we're from, as that often happens in museums, right? And what they really want to know is where you've come from. So I didn't say Charlottesville, whatever. I said, "Well, oh, Scotland." The guy looks at me, and then Scott intervenes and says in his broad Glaswegian accent and said, "Oh, do you charge people from Scotland extra?" And the guy looks at me and he said, "No, we charge Bruins fans extra." So I don't know whether he, I can't believe he knew he could would have recognized a Boston accent, because I've kind of lost that, I think. Although maybe it came out when I said we were from Scotland, but or maybe he just routinely says that they charge Bruins fans extra. So I was a little annoyed until I saw the Bruins exhibit there. We did go see the Stanley Cup, and there were a lot of Toronto fans there because they were all wearing Toronto Blue Jays gear for the baseball, because there was a game that
Sure.
day. And there was a family posing with the Stanley Cup in Blue Jays gear. And I was a little embittered, and I sort of muttered, "Well, that's as close as you're getting to the Stanley Cup." But anyway, that's me. So that was my trip to the Hockey Hall of Fame. Wow. So David, I've now in the course of the past couple of minutes managed to offend everybody in the Southern United States, and now most people in Ontario who support the
Okay,
Toronto.
well that's good.
So
You're
I'm,
having
yeah,
this
I'm really.
narrowing window of places you can travel in the future.
I
You
can
have
only
this.
live in New England and Scotland in the future.
All right.
Anyway, Canadian iced tea, much better than American iced tea. There you go. That's my last drop. What's yours?
All right. So this is slightly more history related, but only I guess slightly. And that is the fine folks at the people University of Chicago Press have released the details of the 18th edition of the New Chicago Manual of Style, which is coming out in September. It's going to be a slightly different color than the orange we're used to, but they've made some important changes to the Chicago Manual of Style. And we're not going to get the full details until September when the book actually comes out. But one of the interesting ones is they're dropping the place of publication from bibliographies and footnotes, which is going to be a very hard change for me to make because I've got that sort of wired in my brain for decades now. And not putting place of publication is going to be very hard for me. But I'm going to try to adjust to the new paradigm, which is putting the publisher in the year.
How do you feel about this?
I'm trying to embrace the new world and the new reality as it exists. You know, I'm not somebody who is precious about these kinds of things, but I'm sure I'm going to do it wrong. After rebuking students for doing it wrong for years, I'm going to probably do it wrong for a couple of years before I really come to grips with it. Do you have feelings about place of publication? Only historians have feelings about these things.
No, and this engendered a lot of debate on social media, as you know.
Yes.
So I have a slightly different view, akin to my views on iced tea, which is I would put place of publication but drop publisher, which I think looks
Right.
more elegant. So you say New York 2024 instead of Simon and Schuster 2024. But that's because that's how you handle pre-modern
Sure.
references usually, or as long as we don't go to what they do in the social sciences, which
Oh,
is having the
no.
references in brackets after the after the quote. So
Oh, no,
I
that's entirely heretical. That's that
yeah,
that's yeah.
it's
But
going to be hard for me to adjust to, because I, like you, I'm just used to publisher, place of publication, date.
Please.
But
Yeah, and
we'll
having commas and colons in the right place, and trying to sort of make sure that students do that properly has always been something that I care about for stupid reasons. But adjusting for new th and there's other kind of changes they're making that are interesting. We will see how that new volume is received and when we actually get it in September. Right. On that note, good talking to
I'm
you,
raising
Brian.
a
Till
cup
next
of
week.
tea, David. I'm
Oh,
raising a
geez.
cup of, it's hot tea. It's
It's
proper tea
hot.
to you.
Oh, Jesus Christ. I'm going to dump it in the harbor. Right. Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.